From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the White House confirms the beheading of an American held by the Islamic State. A stock market link between Shanghai and Hong Kong opens.
I do think that it's right to sort of make a big deal out of it, but on the other hand, the immediate impact of the scheme is not likely to be that big.
And experts say the Western diet is bad for health and the environment. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The White House Sunday confirmed the beheading of American aid worker Abdul Rahman Kasig, formerly known as Peter Kasig, the third American to be decapitated in Syria by Islamic State militants. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the latest execution occurred as the top U.S. military official met with senior Iraqi and Kurdish officials, and the U.S. began advising and training Iraqi security forces in restive western Anbar province.
In a statement, President Barack Obama offered prayers and condolences to the parents and family of Kasig, whose life, quote, was taken from us in an act of pure evil by a terrorist group that the world rightly associates with inhumanity. The White House said, while IS revels in the slaughter of innocents, Kasig was a humanitarian who worked to save the lives of Syrians injured and dispossessed by the Syrian conflict. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who lauds Kasig for his service as an Army Ranger in Iraq, says he was a humanitarian who sought to ease the suffering of others.
I think the fact that he went back to help the people that he saw that needed help says everything about who he was and what he believed. There are people who have extraordinary values and principles in their lives, like Peter Kasig did, and he applied that, and it cost him his life.
The 26-year-old Kasig, who witnessed the suffering of the Syrian people while visiting the region as a college student in 2012, was captured in eastern Syria in October 2013 while delivering relief supplies for the aid group he founded. He is the fifth Westerner beheaded by IS. The militant Sunni group executed American journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff and British aid workers David Haynes and Alan Henning. Kasig's parents, Ed and Paula of Indianapolis, Indiana, who pleaded in a video last month to IS to spare their son's life, said they were heartbroken by the news. Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel stands with the U.S. in the battle against IS.
We support President Obama in leading this coalition. It has to be fought. ISIS has to be defeated, and it can be defeated.
The Israeli leader says the Middle East is awash in militant Islamists, Sunni and Shia, and in a reference to Iran's nuclear ambitions, says they must not be allowed to acquire weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. is stepping up its training and advising mission of Iraqi forces battling IS fighters, with plans to train up to 12 brigades, including 9 Iraqi units and 3 comprised of Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. The top U.S. military official, General Martin Dempsey, met with Iraqi Kurdish officials Sunday in Erbil after holding talks in Baghdad with members of Iraq's central government. RAND Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan, a career army officer, says he believes Dempsey is carrying two messages.
One is that the United States is here to provide the type of assistance that the Iraqi security forces need in order to develop capabilities that have atrophied over the last several years. The other message I think he's trying to emphasize is a great need for the Shia-led government to reach out and mend bridges with the Sunni populace. If you go back to the 2006, 5 and 6 time period, one of the great successes that the United States military had was driving a wedge between the Sunni populace and the predecessor of ISIS, al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Brennan says U.S. forces now operating in Anbar province hope to reestablish that wedge lost during the tenure of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He says their presence at Ain al-Assad Air Base is significant. He says it was envisioned as a training facility had U.S. forces been allowed to stay past 2011. Although U.S. troops were withdrawn, he expects the base to allow the more rapid training of Iraqi security forces. Following the announcement earlier this month that President Obama was authorizing deployment of another 1,500 U.S. troops to Iraq, Brennan says the Obama administration is finally taking actions that should have been implemented months ago. He says the fight against IS will take more U.S. forces than are currently on the ground. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Australia and China have signed a free trade agreement that officials hope will open up markets worth billions of dollars to Australian exporters. The deal was ratified after an address to the Australian Parliament by the Chinese President Xi Jinping. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
President Xi told the Australian Parliament that his goal is to double China's national income by 2020 and create a modern socialist country. He's only the second Chinese leader to address MPs in Canberra. He said Beijing was dedicated to upholding peace and received a standing ovation at the end of his speech. Following his address, the Chinese leader ratified a free trade agreement. It's expected to open up markets to Australian farm exporters and the services sector while easing restrictions on Chinese investment in Australia. All tariffs on Australian resources will be scrapped under the deal, along with duties on beef and sheep exports. The trade pact will make it easier for Australian banks, insurance companies and universities to do business in China. Mr. Xi said Australia is a prosperous and hard-working trading partner.
Australia has a vast territory, rich resources and an advanced economy. And it is renowned for its diverse culture and unique landscape. It is not just a country on the sheep's back or a country sitting on minecarts. More importantly, Australia is a country of dynamism and innovation.
China is Australia's biggest trading partner, and its appetite for iron ore and other resources helped insulate Australia from the worst of the global financial crisis. But as Australia's resources boom begins to fade, Canberra is keen to maintain prosperity through its services, manufacturing and agricultural sectors. Senior government ministers insist the free trade agreement with China is one of the most important Canberra has ever signed. Prime Minister Tony Abbott told Parliament it was a day to remember.
With free trade negotiations concluded and with a comprehensive strategic partnership established, this is a historic and memorable day. Yeah. On behalf of the government and the people of Australia, I welcome His Excellency Xi Jinping on his first visit to Australia as President of China, but on his fifth visit to our country.
Critics of the free trade agreement believe it could raise food prices for Australian consumers. Outside Parliament, demonstrators urge President Xi to ease China's grip on Tibet and end the persecution of religious groups. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
A trading link allowing Hong Kong and Shanghai investors to buy and sell limited shares on each other's exchanges debuted today in an effort to open China's capital markets. Chow Chung Kong, chairman of stock exchange operator Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing, called it a breakthrough in the opening up of China's financial markets and an important milestone in the development of Hong Kong as a unique gateway between the mainland and international investors. The Shanghai Hong Kong Stock Connect platform gives many investors outside mainland China access to the stock market of the world's number two economy for the first time. And it gives Chinese investors access to a market outside of the mainland. Investors will be allowed to buy and sell a total of up to $3.8 billion of stock in a select list of companies each day. Xiao Gong, head of the China Securities Regulatory Commission, said the new platform is conducive to the internationalization of the renminbi. Julian Evans Pritchard, China economic analyst at the Singapore-based Capital Economics, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this will be a gradual process that involves a tiny amount of the market capitalization of each market.
Obviously, it is a major step towards opening up China's capital account. So I do think that it's right to sort of make a big deal out of it. But on the other hand, the immediate impact of the scheme is not likely to be that big. And that's partly because, you know, regulators are taking a very cautious approach, so limiting the quota to about 1% of the market capitalization of each market. it's going to be a very gradual process. So on the one hand, it's a big step in the right direction, but on the other hand, the immediate impact is going to be quite limited, so it's going to be more of a gradual reform and opening up process.
What are the benefits for Chinese equities?
So obviously Chinese equity, you know, now they have a larger pool of international investors. It's more of its significance in terms of a step towards opening up the capital account rather than its impact on the Shanghai market. Probably the bigger impact is actually on the Hong Kong market, because obviously you have the dual listed Chinese firms on each market, but the investors who invest through the scheme from Hong Kong, they're not allowed to short Shanghai stocks. And generally, Shanghai listed firms have been trading at a premium to their listings in Hong Kong. So what we've seen as a result of the scheme is that the price of these shares in Hong Kong is increased, converged to their price in Shanghai, because obviously, you know, that there are arbitrage opportunities once, you know, as the scheme comes into play. So, you know, in recent weeks, we've seen that convergence happen already pretty much. So the impact probably on the Hong Kong market has been bigger.
Is this part of the Chinese government's market reforms?
I think it is, and I think that's one reason why they've, you know, pushed ahead with the scheme, even though, you know, obviously they're not very happy about what's happening in Hong Kong with the protests. But I don't think it was in their interest. I know some people had talked about the possibility of the scheme being cancelled as a result of the Hong Kong protests as a kind of punishment, but I don't think that was in their interest, because it is in their interest as well to launch this scheme, not just in the interest of Hong Kong. For them, it's a very important step for opening up the capital account, but in a very controlled manner, because of the way that they've built the scheme, so that there's a limited cap on daily flows of only around 13 billion RMB. So it allows them to control the flows in between the countries and sort of prevent volatile capital flows, which is often the main concern when you open up the capital account, is that, you know, volatile capital flows can set off financial crises, and that's often happened after countries that didn't have mature enough financial systems, but then went pushed ahead with opening the capital account anyway, and a lot of them have experienced issues. So they're taking a very cautious approach, and this is a way for them to open up gradually, but still keep control over the flows.
Julian Evans Pritchard says if the quota is filled, there may be an incentive to gradually raise the quota and perhaps open up the capital accounts through the already existing Shanghai Free Trade Zone. He says his firm is sticking with its overall 2014 China growth rate of 7.3% and expects four-quarter growth to come in at 7.2%, following the third quarter's 7.3% rate. He expects lower growth rates in coming years in part due to the resilient Chinese labor market. He suggests Chinese policymakers are more interested in reducing credit risks and keeping domestic employment high rather than concentrating on growth.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Exit polls show voters on Japan's southern Okinawa Island have elected a new governor who opposes plans to relocate a key U.S. military base to a less populated part of the island. Victorious opposition candidate Takeshi Onaga instead wants a U.S. Marine Futenma air base removed from the island completely. Onaga's projected win threatens efforts by Washington and Tokyo to resolve a long-standing dispute over future U.S. military presence on the island. It comes as Japan seeks tighter security ties with the United States because of new territorial challenges from China. Japan's Kyoto News Agency, reporting shortly after polls closed, said Onaga was certain to defeat incumbent Hirokazu Nakama, who was backed by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's party. Nakama wanted to move the U.S. base from a crowded urban area to a sparsely populated coastal district. The globalization of Western eating habits is bad for human health and for the environment, according to a new study in the journal Nature. Dietary solutions to this diet, health, environment trilemma exist, but as VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports, they will require a change in eating habits that are heavily influenced by culture, taste, price, and convenience.
In the study, David Tillman analyzed data from 100 countries to chart what people ate and how diet affected health. The University of Minnesota ecology professor noted a trend beginning in the 1960s. As nations industrialized, populations increased, and incomes rose. More people began to adopt the so-called Western diet, one high in refined sugar, fat, oil, and meat. People began to get fatter and sicker.
The excess, let's say, in the 15 richest nations in the world right now is on the order of about 400 or 500 extra calories a day that are eaten beyond what people need, and that leads to people to gain weight.
And overweight people are at greater risk for non-communicable diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and some cancers.
Diabetes is shooting to very high rates in the United States and across Europe. Heart disease is a major cause of mortality in the Western countries. And unfortunately, when people become industrialized, if they adopt this Western diet, they're going to have these same health impacts. And in some cases, if you're Asian, actually have them more severely than even happens in the West.
China, he says, is a case in point where diabetes has skyrocketed.
From less than 1% to 10% of the population having diabetes as they began to industrialize over a 20-year period. And that hasn't leveled off yet. That's still going up. So, and that is happening all across the world, in Mexico and Nigeria and so on, just nation after nation.
And the diet bad for humans is also bad for the environment. As global population grows, experts say more forests and tropical habitats will be converted into farmland for crops or grazing pasture for cattle to meet the increased demand for food.
We're likely to have more greenhouse gas released in the future from agriculture because of this dietary shift than all the greenhouse gas that right now comes out of all of the cars and all the airplanes, boats, and ships, all forms of transportation. So our change in diet is likely to be worse for the world for climate warming than all the transportation sources we use right now.
Writing in the journal Nature, Tillman says the link between diet, the environment, and human health, what he calls a trilemma, is one of the greatest challenges facing humanity. One solution he presents is leaving the Western diet behind, something that Jacqueline Rogers and Mike Richman know something about. The two VOA staffers have each lost 22 kilograms and kept off the weight. Rogers, who has a family history of diabetes, calls herself a reformed carboholic.
I ate lots of carbs all the time. That was my go-to. Pastas, rices, potatoes, breads. I never met any of those things in any form that I didn't like. I had to switch that around, become more vegetable-based, more fruit-based, more protein-based. That plus physical activity made the big difference for me.
Richman says he was always athletic, but could not compete like he used to because he was overweight. He started to go to a gym, lift weights, and run on a treadmill. At the same time, he changed his diet.
It hasn't been anything as complicated as what Jackie's done. I mean, I've just cut out a lot of sweets, a lot of junk, and also just simple things like walking up the stairs and instead of taking the elevator. I always do that. I will not take the elevator at all.
So how do you feel now?
I feel great. I feel that I could probably, if I wanted to play basketball again, I could probably do the same things I did in my 20s and 30s.
My job is sedentary. I have to force myself to get up, go out, walk around the building, walk up the stairs, go to the fifth floor, come on back down. I have to make myself do something throughout the day, not just sit at the computer.
How do you feel?
I feel fantastic. I feel much better. I feel alive. I'm not sluggish. I feel like I can do anything I set my mind to.
Rogers says the switch in lifestyle has been a matter of making better choices, choices that are better for her health and the health of the planet. And she adds she no longer has any sign of diabetes. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Some encouraging developments there. Well, thanks for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 17, 1558, the death of Queen Mary I of England ushered in the first Elizabethan age. The long reign of Mary's half-sister Elizabeth coincided with the advance of the English Renaissance. In 1603, English explorer and writer Sir Walter Raleigh went on trial for treason. Raleigh had been accused in a plot to remove King James I from the throne. Despite a guilty verdict, King James spared Raleigh's life, although the death penalty was later reinstated and carried out. On this day in 1869, the Suez Canal, connecting the Mediterranean and the Red Seas, was opened to navigation in an elaborate ceremony. Financed by the Rothschild banking empire, the 160-kilometer canal eliminated a 6,400-kilometer trip around Africa. On this day in 1969, Soviet and U.S. negotiators met in Helsinki to begin the strategic arms limitation talks. Whether their agreement 3 years later made the world much safer was hard to say. Their nuclear arsenals were still sufficient to destroy the world many times over. On this day in 1973, in the midst of the Watergate scandal that eventually ended his presidency, President Richard Nixon made a now-famous declaration during a televised question-and-answer session with the Associated Press.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Nixon's protestations of innocence with regard to the Watergate cover-up were eventually eroded as a federal investigation revealed his culpability. Nixon resigned the presidency a year later. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the reported arrest by Syrian authorities of prominent Syrian dissident Luai Hussein. Mr. Hussein was allegedly traveling to visit his family in Spain when he was detained near the Syrian-Lebanese border on November 12th. Mr. Hussein has long been a critic of the Assad family, which has ruled Syria for four decades. Under the tenure of Hafez al-Assad, the current leader's father, Mr. Hussein spent 7 years in prison. In 2011, he was again detained by authorities after expressing sympathy for peaceful anti-government protesters in the city of Deraa, who were violently attacked by the forces of Bashar al-Assad, a response by the Syrian president that ignited the conflict that has now resulted in the deaths of nearly 200,000 Syrians and the displacement of millions more. Luai Hussein is the co-founder of a movement called Building the Syrian State and has called for a coalition government to replace Bashar al-Assad. There are reports that a court judge has accused him of weakening national sentiment and weakening the nation's mood. The arrest of Mr. Hussein, who, like the Assad family itself, is a member of the Alawite sect, undercuts the Syrian regime's narrative that its opponents are all terrorists, mostly made up of Sunni extremists. His incarceration shows that anyone who opposes the Assad regime's atrocities, regardless of religion or ethnic background, is vulnerable to arrest and detention in one of the Syrian regime's notorious prisons. Tens of thousands of Syrians continue to be imprisoned by the government from all walks of life: doctors, journalists, children, women, human rights defenders. And many have been subjected to torture, sexual violence, and starvation. The United States calls on all parties in the Syrian conflict to release all arbitrarily detained persons and political prisoners. In particular, the U.S. urges the government of Bashar al-Assad to immediately release Luai Hussein and the thousands of Syrians held in its horrific detention centers. The U.S. also urges the Assad regime to allow immediate, unfettered access by international monitors to all detention facilities. The Assad regime has brought untold suffering to the people of Syria. The United States continues to work for a political solution that alleviates that suffering and lays the foundation for a government without Bashar al-Assad, which is responsive to the will and aspirations of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.